From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, we talk with two acclaimed chefs about their new cookbooks. First, Magnus Nielsen, whose restaurant is on the world's 50 best list, spent the last 3 years gathering recipes and stories for his Nordic cookbook. We talk with the Swedish chef about why he never wanted to write the book in the first place. Then at 10:30, Dominique Krenn made history as the first female chef in the U.S. to earn 2 Michelin stars for her San Francisco restaurant, Atelier Krenn. We'll talk with Krenn about her meals as works of art, growing up in France, and about writing her first cookbook called Atelier Krenn, Metamorphosis of Taste. That's all coming up next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to the second hour of Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Famous dishes at Magnus Nielsen's restaurant Faviken in northern Sweden have included scallops cooked over burning juniper branches, retired dairy cow and reindeer lichen, and trout roe encased in dried pig's blood. His use of hyperlocal ingredients that he hunts and forages for has been featured on the PBS series Mind of a Chef and the Netflix series Chef's Table. Nielsen's latest project is a phone book-sized cookbook called The Nordic Cookbook with 700 recipes spanning the region from Finland to Greenland. Magnus Nielsen, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So I mentioned some of the dishes you serve at Faviken, but your cookbook is a mix of recipes that are nearly impossible to do, but also ones that are as simple as the best way to cook an egg. How did you define the boundaries?
The thing is that those dishes that you mentioned, they're from my first book and they're from Favik in my restaurant. And it's a completely different thing from the book that I've come up with now.
Right.
Because the Nordic cookbook, the new one, it's basically a document of what people eat in their homes, like the current food culture of everyday eating in the whole Nordic region. And actually, not a single recipe in there is mine. They've all been collected during my trips and travels around the region, you know.
And you tested a lot of them.
So I cooked about 400 of them in my own house to test them out. And then the others I tested on site when I collected them.
And a large part of the reason the book is so big is because you're really chronicling Nordic culture as well.
Yeah.
So why didn't you want to write this?
Well, at first I was kind of offended that someone wanted me to write a book about all these different food cultures, lumping it into all one and giving it a name. Because most people in the Nordic region, they will identify themselves with where they live in the region. Like for myself, I'm Swedish. I don't identify myself as being Nordic. And it's a very large region, you know, from Finland in the very east to Greenland in the west, and with geographical vastness also comes diversity in culture. So it just felt kind of wrong.
Yeah, but then as you were working on the project, you wrote later that you couldn't stop almost. Like
No, and that was kind of the reason why I wanted to do it in the end. Was the same reason I didn't want to do it from the beginning, when I started to realize that almost no one actually knows what Nordic cooking is. Simply because like the knowledge, the information that's out there is so limited. You know, you're going to find all of the obvious things like the herrings and the gravlax and the meatballs. And then you might find like a video of Anthony Bourdain eating rotten shark on Iceland. And then you find a lot of articles about very ambitious restaurants like my own. And that's it, you know, which is not a very representative picture of what people actually eat on an everyday basis.
Yeah, you know, I think the Disney movie Frozen also brought lutefisk back out as well. And that's, people have been asking a lot of questions about that. So then when you are chronicling traditions, you included ones, some that were even controversial, right? The one at the Faroe Islands I'm thinking of, where you document the killing of pilot whale.
Yeah. And to me, like, this was kind of something that was debated quite a bit with the publisher and also, like, with myself. Because I felt like if you decide that you're going to document the food culture, you can't impose too much of your own personal opinions on what's in the content. You actually have to tell what's there. And if those dishes that are, you know, representative for a small part of the region but not very common would be, you know, excluded simply because they're controversial, the book wouldn't be a document. It wouldn't be a documentary of the food culture of the region.
And, you know, there is a pretty graphic image of the pilot whale killing where the water is really reddened with blood. And so I guess I can almost imagine what some of the conversations must have been like. You took that photograph?
I took that photo. Yeah.
You took
So I was on
many
site.
Of the photographs.
I took all of the atmospherics and documentary photos in the book. I didn't shoot the images of the food because I cooked that when I was testing it in my kitchen and someone else photographed it.
And so photography is a big part of your other creative pursuits?
It is. I've always photographed, you know, since I was 6 or 7 years old, and I always enjoyed it a lot. But I always photographed for myself, not for publishing. So this is kind of new to me as well.
And I read that you close Faviken, your restaurant in northern Sweden, for a handful of months throughout the year to pursue creative pursuits and to also encourage your staff to do that too.
Yeah, we've done that different. You know, in different ways in different years. And last year we closed for 20 weeks, which is a very long time even for us, because we had a lot of different things going on and like big projects that needed to be finished and so on. This year we're going to close a little bit less in 2016. So we'll close for 7 weeks.
But that's a pretty big thing to do.
It is.
Pursuing creative things must be really important to you. And I'm wondering how that fits in with, you know, your overall life and whether it helps you feel like, in terms of your cooking. And
I think it's very important, you know, if you're if you're working in a very ambitious restaurant, it's very easy to get completely caught up and absorbed into that and to do nothing else. You know, you're in the restaurant almost every day, you do kind of the same things almost every day, which can be very good and very interesting, but it also disallows you from having other input, you know, having experiencing other things. Which I think is really important, because ultimately that's going to lead to a better product in your restaurant, you know, and a more interesting creative process.
We're talking with Magnus Nilsson, chef at Faviken in Sweden, his restaurant that we were just talking about, and now author of The Nordic Cookbook. Nilsson was featured in the PBS series The Mind of a Chef and the Netflix documentary series Chef's Table. We're talking with him for just a half hour, so if you have a question for him, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email us your questions at forum@kqed.org. Post them on our website, kqed.org/forum, or find us on Facebook and Twitter. I read that you take issue with descriptions of how hard it is to get to your restaurant. It's been described as the most isolated or remote gourmet restaurant in the world. So how hard is it to get to Faviken?
Well, it depends on where you're going from, really. But the thing is that...
But it's like 500 miles north of Stockholm, is that right?
Yeah, but it really depends on what you compare with. Because, like, for example, going from... like, a lot of our customers are from other countries. Let's say that you're coming from New York to, you know, to visit a few restaurants in Europe. You take a direct flight from New York to Stockholm, and then you take a domestic flight from Stockholm to a city called Östersund. It's a 45-minute flight, and then you're 45 minutes away in a car from the restaurant. That's much easier than going from New York to, for example, Basque Country. And no one says anything about those restaurants being remotely located.
Well, I'm sure it's in part because it is, what, winter in the region about 6 months out of the year, is that right?
Or not quite, maybe four. Okay. But it's I think it's also because it's very easy to communicate. So when people write articles and pieces about the restaurant, some of those sort of very striking things like the remoteness is very easy to communicate. And maybe sometimes it's a bit over-exaggerated.
Or romanticized in some way, too. Yeah. We like to think of this remote.
Which is fine. But
but also, it seats only, what, some 12 to 16 people?
It's 16 people in the dining room. And then we have a communal table for 8 also in the entry floor. So absolute maximum is 24 guests per night.
But pretty much if people want to eat there from far, who've come from far away, they would need to stay.
Yeah, we're located about 20 minutes away from a really big ski resort called Åre. So those who we can't fit in the hotel, because our hotel is really small, it's only 6 rooms, we can help them, you know, to find lodging over there instead.
And the region is called, and I'm going to try to pronounce this, Jämtland.
Yeah.
And when I watched the PBS documentary, at one point you say, I didn't like Jämtland and for a while, and then now you love it. What didn't you like about it?
I think it's like when most people grow up, you know, you kind of want to deliver it yourself from where you grew up, and maybe move somewhere else in the world, or move on, basically. And I did, and I returned, and I never thought I was going to return. And when I did, started sort of actually living up there again, I realized that I really like it.
What drew you back?
It was pure coincidence. I was just hired for sort of a short-term consultancy at Faviken to work with the wine cellar in 2008, and you know, I got along really well with the owners and we started working together.
And Faviken existed before as a restaurant that served like 120 people. I heard it popular with big groups and things like that.
No, it started in 1986. So I didn't start it. I just sort of came there and changed it a little bit.
So were any of the locals angry when it went from being this big 120 capacity restaurant to a more exclusive restaurant?
Not really, because the locals didn't go there anyway. It was a restaurant for tourists, you know, and for like conference groups and stuff like that. So it wasn't an open restaurant.
Well, how do you cook in the winter when there's nothing? Because, I mean, you've turned essentially a region that's very sparse in terms of vegetation for many months out of the year and into a place that produces high art. I mean, it's like the 25th best restaurant in the world.
The thing is that it's much less difficult than people think to cook in the winter, because in most parts of the Northern Hemisphere, like here in California, obviously you have a really good growing climate and you can harvest things almost year round. But just a little bit further north, if you buy, for example, a carrot in January, someone else is going to have harvested that in the end of summer and, you know, stored it for you. It's still a fresh carrot. It's just been stored. And we just do it ourselves. So it's not that different, you know.
Beth asks, being Scandinavian on our mom's side, we grew up eating healthy Swedish meals and have since been vegetarian with occasional salmon. How many recipes in Magnus Nielsen's new cookbook would appeal to vegetarians or even vegans?
Yeah. So, there is a section on vegetables that's quite comprehensive. And the way the book is structured is that it's not really that many complete dishes. There are components of dishes and narrative instructions on how to combine them. So I think it would be fairly easy to pick together like quite a few vegetarian meals out of that book.
And let's go to some calls. Alan in Santa Rosa. Hi, Alan.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm well.
Very good.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me on. My sister back in New York, where I'm originally from, is an aspiring chef. And, you know, for the past few years, it seems like she's had a rough time sort of finding a groove and everything, being self-taught. It seems like she's having a rough time finding, an establishment that'll, you know, give her a real kind of fair shake at it. And I wanted to know if maybe you had any words of advice or some wisdom that maybe I could pass on to her.
I think it can be really difficult, especially in the beginning of one's career. And there are a lot of like obstacles to overcome before you're established enough so you can start sort of shaping your own everyday life and your work life. But my advice would be like to keep on cooking, because otherwise like you have to do that to get better. But the other thing that's really important is to keep on doing other things also, you know, to get other influences, because a life with, you know, filled with only cooking, it's not going to be very interesting or very productive in the long run.
Alan, thanks for the question. And Magnus Nielsen, how have you incorporated, you know, different regional styles of cooking or your experiences into your cooking at Faviken?
I think that as a creative person, what you produce, which is in my case, you know, the experience of the meal and the food, it's inevitably going to be a composite of everything that you have with you, you know, everything that you've experienced and seen so far. And obviously with this book, having traveled so much in the Nordic region and spent so much time researching and writing the book, that has become a big part of, you know, my everyday over the last 3 years. And it's also influenced the product at Faviken quite a lot from that.
And what about outside the Nordic region? Have you brought in things that you learned? I mean, I know you spent time in Paris. Have you brought in from other countries?
Yeah. And it's the same thing there, because I don't filter deliberately what ends up on the menu at Faviken. I just kind of, you know, that's to me a very intuitive thing. So if I experience something that I think is fantastic in Thailand, for example, there's a good chance that that's somehow going to influence what we do at Faviken. It's not always very clear how, but I think it will.
Rick asks, when your restaurant is closed for up to 20 weeks a year, is it paid leave for your staff?
It depends a little. I mean, some people are on like a seasonal contract and they move on somewhere else when they're done. But for the whole like the core team, it's actually not leave; it's paid work, because we're not on vacation for 20 weeks. We actually work on projects. It's just that we don't have guests.
I see. Where are your employees from? Are most of them native Jutlanders? Or?
So there are. It's the only people from the region is me and Karin, who is my restaurant manager. And then there are a few other Swedish people, and the rest are from other parts of the world.
Like where? How?
Like everywhere. you know, we have people from several European countries, Australia, Canada, Japan, Singapore. We don't have any Americans at the moment, though.
Really? And they adjust to the temperatures.
It seems like it.
Is that one of the hardest things to adjust to?
People think that the hardest thing to adjust to is going to be the darkness in winter. And it quite often turns out that it's actually the light in summer that's the most difficult thing for people to adjust to. And can sort of turns people's sleeping schedule on their heads a little bit.
Mm. You know, we just had a show earlier about GMO salmon.
Yeah, I read something about that.
I was curious what your reaction to that is. So salmon is a big part of.
Yeah, I think it's like, to me, it's so foreign with all of those things that we're pushing so hard in general to produce more products instead of maybe starting in the other end and figuring out how to stop wasting like 30 to 50% of all the food we produce. Maybe if we didn't waste as much food, we wouldn't need to have a salmon that grew twice as fast.
How is climate change affecting traditional food stocks?
Well, like food culture is quite interesting in the sense that it's the only cultural expression that we all have to relate to, simply because we all eat in some way. Regardless where we live, regardless of our sort of financial situation, all that, we all have to eat. And it's also one of the cultural expressions that most quickly mirrors changes in the places where it's practiced.
Right.
So it's really a good way of like, you know, reading and learning it all about society in which we live.
So are you seeing and having to make adjustments even based on climate change to some degree?
Where I live, we haven't seen that much. We are not that affected so far. But, you know, you read the newspapers and you see what's happening in other parts of the world for sure. And, you know, people will adapt to that.
Camilla asks, I'm interested in cooking with lichen.
Yep.
Recipes, procedures. You know, maybe you could first just describe the lichen you work with. What does it taste like?
So lichen is used traditionally in a few food cultures, some of which in the Nordic region, as a source of carbohydrates, especially in, you know, years where perhaps, you know, had, you know, crop failure in grains and stuff like that. People could dilute their wheat flour, for example, with 30% lichen. And on Iceland, they do like a lichen porridge as well. And it's like to eat lichen. There are many, many, many types of varieties of lichen, right? And not all of them are actually edible. But those who are, if you eat them, they tend to be like untreated, quite bitter, and not very palatable. So you have to work with them a lot.
And so, as Camilla is asking, how best to cook with it?
There's actually a few techniques described in the book. And like one that's kind of a common denominator is that you need to neutralize something called lichenic acid, which is what makes the lichen very, very bitter, and it's not very good for your stomach. And traditionally, that's made with potash. So basically, you have ash from your stove, which is mixed with water to produce a potash solution, and then you put the lichen in there, and you get that. It's a bit like nixtamalizing corn, actually, like they would do in South America. Same process. And then you can cook it, and the lichenic acid is neutralized, and the carbohydrates become more accessible as well.
So you traveled all over and learned so many different recipes from folks, what they actually cook traditionally in their homes. Besides Sweden, what Nordic country do you think has the most interesting food culture?
Oh, that's very difficult to answer. There's just so much variety everywhere. And I think to me, like, what was most surprising and most interesting was that I thought I knew the Nordic region quite well and its food culture also. And it turned out like 2 days into the research process that I just realized I didn't.
And how did you come to realize that?
You know, just by seeing how much there were out there that I had no idea existed. And to me, that's been fantastic, you know, to get to do all of this research and learn more about the region and its food culture.
Do you have a specific example?
of something that I learned?
Yes,
or
that you were really surprised by, or...
Oh, that's so difficult. There are so many. There is, for example, one technique on Iceland, which is not very... It's not very common, and it's kind of an oddity, but it's still interesting because I didn't know it existed. And it resembles the technique of producing thousand-year-old eggs in Asia. And they collect these eggs in spring, wild duck's eggs, and put them in boxes with ash, which is alkaline, and that cures and kind of desiccates the egg. And that's something that I had no idea it existed. Very, very few people practice this technique. It's not very common, but it's still kind of an interesting example of regional variety.
So then for folks who want to try and attempt some of these recipes or substitute some of the ingredients, you've spent some time in San Francisco. Where are the best places to go? I mean, and I'll admit, I think for some of us, the place where we see Swedish food is IKEA.
I think that like the one thing that's interesting with this is that out of those 730 something recipes in the book, I would say that about 50 are recipes that no one is ever going to cook because you can't get the produce, not in the Nordic region either. But they are still important because they explain something about food culture. And the rest of the recipes, they are recipes that have been, you know, that people cook on an everyday basis up there. And if they do so, most of them are actually going to work here also. And I think it's important not to get too caught up in the kind of most exotic extremes of Nordic cooking. Because we also cook with beef and pork and chicken and broccoli and most of the things that you'll find anywhere else in the kind of Western world.
So what do you think of the availabilities at IKEA? Are they...
IKEA is, you know, an industrial representation of food culture. They're restaurants like any other enormous restaurant. So I don't really have another opinion on that.
Well, Jessica writes, "The Mind of a Chef was a wonderful series. I loved his use of the root cellar with all the canning and pickling. Mm-hmm. The modern world has forgotten how to eat locally and with the seasons and to preserve foods for winter. With climate change, California's drought, and ridiculous food waste, all things that you mentioned, it's time we start looking at smarter consumption."
I think so, too. I think that's like the where you should start. Instead of trying to figure out new ways of producing more food, we should try to figure out how to use less food instead and be more careful with it.
And how could you just give one example of how you do that, what you mean by smarter consumption?
Well, I'm not an expert on that. I can just see that the problem is there. You
practitioner.
Know? Yeah. No, I don't think I'm the right person to actually do that, but I can see that the problem is there. And then more clever people than me will probably figure this out at some point.
And certainly you really do look locally as much as possible.
Yeah. But, you know, on the other hand, it's like a restaurant like Faviken, even though we inspire like thousands and thousands of people to think more about what they eat, like we're not a very sustainable restaurant in the sense that most people that come to eat with us, they travel from, you know, all across the world. So it's really like there are many facets to this question.
Well, Magnus Nielsen, it really was a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for coming in and congratulations on the Nordic Cookbook.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, we'll have San Francisco chef Dominique Krenn join us. She is chef at Atelier Krenn. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum.